Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Catholic bishops from G8 nations appeal to their leaders to prioritize the needs of the poor at the forthcoming summit in Japan. And combating poverty, building peace is the theme for next year's World Peace Day message. The Secretary General of Pax Christi talks about the vital links between development and peace. But first, with just over a week to go before the start of World Youth Day in Australia, we find out how those last-minute preparations are shaping up. Welcome to the programme. In Sydney, Australia, and in dioceses across the country, the countdown to World Youth Day continues as organisers prepare to welcome several hundred thousand young Catholics and church leaders, including Pope Benedict XVI, for this major event. As the Pope and the young pilgrims begin packing their bags for the journey down under, Emma McCarthy reports on some final preparations taking place in Sydney itself.
With only 10 days to go, on Friday, the body of Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, one of the 10 World Youth Day patrons, arrived in Sydney. It is the first time that the body of this charismatic blessed, who was renowned for his social activism and generous spirit, has left Turin, Italy since his death there in 1925. In mass marking Blessed Pier Giorgio's feast day, which coincided with his arrival at the port city, Cardinal George Pell urged people gathered in St. Benedict's Church at Notre Dame University to be inspired by the blessed's practice of his deep faith in the everyday events of his life. On July 11th, the body of Blessed Pier Giorgio will be moved to St. Mary's Cathedral, the focal point for pilgrims during the week-long event of World Youth Day. Indeed, St. Mary's will also be the final resting place of the World Youth Day cross and icon. In its 24-year history, the cross still remains the most tangible symbol of World Youth Day. It arrived in Australia after a marathon relay across Asia and the South Pacific Islands. Since then, they have been out to the bush churches, they have journeyed to Ayers Rock and Alice Springs and have been greeted by almost 400,000 people. But on Saturday, July 5th, they begin the very last leg of their journey. Commencing at Wollongong Cathedral, the 3.8-metre wooden cross and icon of Our Lady will be accompanied by an Indigenous message stick as they are walked through the streets of Greater Sydney, its satellite towns, slums and suburbs, winding their way over the next 10 days to the heart of this modern city, Hyde Park. Organisers are calling for all Sydneysiders, Christian and non-Christian alike, to come to meet the cross on its journey over the next 10 days and to join in one of the longest street processions in Sydney's history. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Climate change, spiralling food prices, the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and the need for better education to lift people out of poverty. Those are amongst the most pressing issues facing our planet today, and they're also the issues topping the agenda as leaders of the Group of Eight Wealthiest Nations meet for a summit in Japan next week. From July 7th to 9th, the prime ministers and presidents of the US, Canada, Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Italy and Russia meet amid tight security on the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido to discuss ways of bringing down soaring oil prices, getting the world's economy back on track and meeting the Millennium Development Goals of tackling poverty, illiteracy and disease, especially in Africa. Ahead of the summit, the heads of the Catholic bishops' conferences in those eight nations have written to their leaders, urging them to put national interests aside and focus on the need for concrete action to promote the common good, especially of the poorest nations of the world. The cardinals and bishops who signed the letter applaud the summit's focus on development and Africa and appeal to those world leaders to build on commitments made at previous summits in Germany last year and Gleneagles, Scotland in 2005.
So the letter is an attempt to follow up on last year, 2007, the same gathering of G8 countries.
Joseph Donnelly heads the Caritas Internationalis delegation at the UN in New York. He told my colleague Kelsey Brennan-Wessels more about the aims and the impact of this letter to the G8 leaders.
The Catholic bishops made visits to the respective counterparts in the governments to confirm for them their profound commitment to aid development and eradication of poverty, and to applaud efforts but also challenge that status. So this year's letter is an attempt to follow that up in a very concrete way and once again encourage the process, but also to say, you know, as the G8 approaches in Japan, that these commitments are radically important. And if we're going to reduce global poverty, address global climate change and all the multifaceted constituent impacts, it's now, it's not later, and it's in this dialogue and partnership now, and not just allocating some numbers and making some vague commitments, but in great specificity, and then in relationship to each other. That unilateral approaches just don't do this. It's all about partnership and delivery, and partnership on the basis of the local countries where the concerns are most dramatic.
What are they hoping to accomplish by sending this letter? What sort of outcome are they expecting?
Well, I think it's that's a good question, and I think it's a part of the challenge of partnership today is to say we're not merely commentators from sidelines, but that the faith-based community and the faith-based leadership is quintessential to the conversation in civil society, that part of the role of bishops in the world, their pastoral response is a human and a civil one as well for the community where they live and for the communities at large. So that sense of global citizenship is a fundamental gospel calling, and to be in solidarity with people in need. The sense of the letter is to say that these are fundamental realities for the church in action. And so concern for the poor, walking with the poor, is part and parcel of the daily life of the church in all its representative ways and places, from the grassroots up, from the top down, and vertically and horizontally, which creates this community of action. And that for us, the poor are real people, real names, real faces, real places. And the letter and the advocacy does confirm then for governments that this is not a capricious commentary, that we are integral players, stakeholders. And since the G8 countries themselves would each have religious and particularly Catholic representation, some greater and lesser, but even, for example, Japan, where it'd be rather small, but it's respected and known, and that our commitment on the ground is with the poor and for the poor, and therefore the bishops would have a sense of responsibility to bring that voice there. And what I understand is that it has even more traction and credibility precisely because it comes from the ground up. It's based on connections to the local bishops' conferences all over the world on these human social needs that can't be addressed independently and must be addressed collectively. So I believe that the letters and the messages are taken quite seriously, and I think it also demonstrates then that the church has a sense of partnership with all people involved in civil society and with the government, so that to be out of the conversation could be to miss an opportunity to comment.
Now, is there any particular need that is of more importance than the other ones that the Catholic Bishops' Conference would like the G8 to focus on in particular?
Well, I think at the moment, one of the ones that jumps out at people is the global food crisis, and how do we get to that situation. Some would say it isn't a food crisis, it's an economic crisis, it's a food resource crisis. So the issue is people are hungry, and certainly we know that people are starving. How is that happening? And people are dying. What can be done to prevent that? And so, yes, we could quickly rally up and get food into the hands and homes of certain, desperate communities. But if that's a one-off deal, it doesn't have any sustainable value to anyone. What are the deeper issues? So I think that things like agriculture and the climate change challenge, all these things question how are we managing the resources we have, and certainly from a faith and ethics point of view, what is our sense of stewardship and accountability to, first of all, benefit the people where these natural resources exist, You know, is there food security in the country? If there isn't, why? If there are great natural resources in a country, but they're exploited by others, what then are the consequences locally? If all of that stirs up crisis, then it means that all these the integration of a quality of life and sustaining honest, authentic community are fractured by all the impacts that take away from concentrating development resources, development expertise in the places where people are in need. So there is a challenge here, and I think it is the great concern of the bishops in their statement, is to say, are we making the most of what we have? Are we including the local people in that conversation? And it's not enough to make, you know, bold commitments from rich countries without a sense of how will this happen. So I think the overriding concern for the bishops, whichever side you come into the perspective of needs, is it effective? And are these commitments being implemented when they've come as government commitments? And are they being monitored so that it isn't a one-size-fits-all or a one-time-only response, but an ongoing, evolving, really integrated approach to development and its effectiveness that also has an ownership locally, not just by the local community's need, but by the local governments as well? So the bilateral relationships between, you know, a country with a population in need or an economy in need and donor countries who support it, it has to be really still integrated and not private deals on the sidelines of the what's best for the local society.
Is there any particular need that has made significant progress in the past few years?
I'm reluctant to say any have made significant progress, maybe as more one than the other. I think that there has been, you know, attention on HIV/AIDS. There has been attention on climate change. The problem is there's been the variations of progress, and in quotes I would say success, make for small success stories and small pockets of development, but collectively the problem remains the same. And there's so many variables that go into altering the possibility of progress that the fear here, and I think this would be the overriding challenge, is that while commitments were made, there have been ships in that commitment, and government commitments to overseas disaster assistance called ODA has changed enough that some countries have slipped back, and there's a real challenge to say, where does that come from? You may see shortly there is a secular press story getting out in the last today or next days of G8 leaders ready to backtrack on Africa aid. And the question is to say, are the pledges that are made, are they slipping? You know, we have this, the needs to eradicate poverty. We have health. We have education. You know, we have HIV/AIDS. We have climate change. How do we sustain those commitments while we're learning more and moving into new directions and new understanding of needs if the funds that we appropriated to column A are now cut in half and part of that is put in column, you know, D, but it's less money, it's not more money, but then we make an announcement that we've pledged X amount of money to column D when really what we've done is take half of it from another dramatic need. So part of the G8 call to action from the bishops and others, from ourselves, is to ask the question that we not change the paradigm here. We just state quite practically, here's the basic needs. Here's what absolutely is needed to begin to have a sustainable, progressive response to the need. And when we add things to the column of needs, which is life, you know, it's inevitable, that we're not taking the resources or the commitment from one already pledged commitment and now reallocating that. That's obviously pretty dangerous and leads to more disastrous consequences in the development world. And the challenge that we, as part of civil society, are presenting is to keep on track and to find an ownership and accountability also at the local level, that the local governments and countries in need are also honest and transparent in their response to what can we do with this, and not simply kind of a quick take the money and run or simplistic approaches. That's really not going to help anybody. And in the end, the poor remain poor. So I think one of the challenges of the question of where's the progress made is The progress for us would be made if the commitments that are there are sustained, acted upon, and in a transparent way reflected on. Where there are variations, which would be inevitable because it's human and it's life, but that it isn't a slip sliding backwards subtly and maybe getting obfuscated by big numbers and not really sort of speaking truth to reality.
Thanks there to Joseph Donnelly, head of the Caritas Internationalis delegation at the United Nations in New York. He'll be one of those following very closely the working of the G8 summit in Japan next week. And he was speaking to my colleague Kelsey Brennan-Wessels. These crucial questions of combating poverty and guaranteeing development for the poorest countries will also be at the heart of Pope Benedict's message for the next World Peace Day, celebrated on January the 1st each year. The Vatican announced this week that the theme for the 2009 World Peace Day will be Combating Poverty, Building Peace.
We do not have money to feed people. We do not have money for HIV/AIDS. We do not have money for water consumption. All the real important issues, but we do have money when it comes, you know, to prepare nuclear bombs and other weapons, you know.
Claudette Worley is Secretary General of Pax Christi International and a former Prime Minister of her native Haiti in the mid-1990s. She spoke with my colleague Ema McCarthy about the often crucial connections between poverty alleviation and peace.
I think that nowadays more people are aware of it, you know, because recently through the media we have seen people from different parts of the world making big demonstrations because of food shortages. So up to now it has been non-violent, which is good, you know. But if unless we find or let's say the people who are taking decision and are really or who can make a difference at global level, do something about it, then that means that people will go toward violence, you know, because even in the rich countries, we see how people are saying that now the cost of living is too high for them. So you can just imagine how it is, you know, for poor countries like mine, because I'm from Haiti, you know. So that means that we have had for the past 20, 30 or 40 years build up society with a lot of consumption, and people have been really trying to have more or more money, but not trying to solve the problems, you know, of the needed. And this at one time really can cause and is already causing problems.
Can you talk to us a little bit more about what is being done to prove that by tackling poverty, we can bring peace, by looking at the initiatives in your country, perhaps?
Yeah, that's right. But unfortunately, I will have to convince you the other way around, because what has happened to us, at the contrary, is to show that some of the policy and economic policy that we have actually implemented, thinking that this would solve our problem, at the contrary, has made the situation worse. Let's say that 20 years ago, what they were always telling us, you know, it's, you know, in order to develop, in order for a poor country, you know, to live, then we would have to go and make comparative advantage. You know, for example, what we can produce is, let's say, coffee or cocoa or things like that, you know. So just concentrate into doing that, because then you will have enough money to buy food and etc. So that means that a lot of countries, and I am not talking only about Haiti, have gone into that planting crops, you know, for consumption, mostly from the north by the northern countries. But what happened during those past several decades also is that a lot of the crops from the south are now being produced in the north. And it's not only because of climate change, but also because of scientific discovery. So that means that, or even genetic food. So that means that now you find a lot of crops like corn and rice being produced in the north. In the case of Haiti, for example, we have received during the years of in the 80s a lot of rice coming mostly from the United States at a very low price, much cheaper than what was produced. So that means that poor people could not afford buying food from the peasant, from our country. So that means that now that all the prices have jumped and are very high, then that means that it's not only the poor that cannot afford buying the food, even people from the middle class and high middle class now find difficulties now to find to be able to survive. So that means that this is a good example where when policies are just to try to make money and now not trying to see to tackle the needs of the people, needs for water, needs for food, needs for proper education and for health, then that means that we're going out and, of course, when people do not have their basic necessities provided for or solved, then the risk to have people become violent, you know, is much, much greater.
Basically, what you're saying is because of these past policies, Haitians were encouraged to mass produce crops that at a very day-to-day level are of no use to the people in Haiti because they've been concentrating on producing crops such as cocoa and not on crops to feed the population.
Yeah, but I'm talking to you because it's not only a matter of the past. At the moment, not only in Haiti and a lot of other countries, now because of the oil crisis or because of the price of oil being petroleum being so high, a lot of soil, a lot of land that could produce food now is being used and there's pressure to use them for agro production, you know, but for mostly
biofuels.
For biofuel, you know, or agro fuel, you know. So that means that this is very short political, very short policy. So that means that if we go by this code, so that means that yes, maybe, and it's not even sure that people could use gas for the tanks to put in the vehicle. But the basic issue is not that. The basic issue is to have food for the people, you know. So here I think that we are really getting into, we are looking toward very new trends for next wars to come, and it will be coming. I don't know if it Haiti would be first or it could be other countries, you know, but it is very clear that we already have the signals.
Of the next war, which could possibly be over something as simple as people who are hungry.
That's right. Hunger and water, because water also is becoming more and more a problem. 50 years ago or 60 years ago, it was just people would not even think of buying water or selling water, you know. But now, being done all over, and a lot of places, precisely the people who pay more for water are the poorest, you know, because the other ones can afford several other ways, you know, to get good water. But the poor people cannot afford preparing it themselves, so that means that then they have to buy it, you know. And since they have less money, so that means that it becomes really a problem.
What does Pax Christi see as being the prime issue that must be addressed within the next G8 meeting?
Really, unless there is a big change in our way of living, the pattern, you know, that we are presented as the best way to live, you know. So that means that unless there is a real change in that, then that means that we are condemned to create poorer and poorer people, and we are condemned to have, we have potential for war. And something else, you know, that has come out those past years is that before there was like that tension between rich and poor, but now we have seen with what happened recently, for example, in South Africa, a lot of people from Zimbabwe, some poor people were refugees there, but it was poor people, you know, starting to rebel against them, you know. So that means that when there is a lot of scarcity, then it's not only a problem of rich and poor, but it is even between the poorest population that there will be more tension, you see. And the poorest people are the majority of the people. Once upon a time, the poor people could, even when they were poor, could share among themselves, you know, share bread, share their food. But when there is scarcity, and so that means that among themselves, they are condemned to fight for food, you know. Then that puts in jeopardy the whole structure and our whole life, you know, not only the poor people, but also everybody, the rich people, everybody, you know. So I think that people certainly should do about it, should do something about it. But coming back to your question, I think that a lot of issues should be tackled at the next G8 meeting. For example, the countries, the richest countries, have themselves taken the decision to do something against poverty. And at the moment, if they would have used 10% of the money that is being used for military spending, those goals would have been met. You know, so we do not have money to feed people. We do not have money for HIV/AIDS. We do not have money for water consumption. All the real important issues, but we do have money when it comes, you know, to prepare nuclear bombs and other weapons, you know. So that means that in that way of thinking about security, so that means that we do not really tackle the real issue, which is not only poverty, but to have people have a decent life, which is the only way for people to feel happy and relaxed the way they are. So that means that they have no reason, you know, to try to fight against each other, you know. So it is the whole issue which is being tackled the wrong way.
Thanks there to Claudette Wehrli, Secretary General of Pax Christi International and a former Prime Minister of her native Haiti. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.